Little White Lies been around for years. Little White Lies ringing in your ears. You turn around, come around back on you. Well, that little white lie's catching up to you.
You know, the point of this is to remind people that their economic misery has been caused by bankers who have made it easy for banks to make money with almost no risk, because you bear the risk. They don't bear any of the risk. Now, it's funny because the language is changing to try to cover up these facts.
Capitalism. No one says that word anymore. Funny, hey? Capitalism.
Let's illustrate by analogy how it all started. I want you to imagine a nursery where 20 kids are playing happily. They have the old spat now and again, but nothing serious. If you've been in kindergartens yourself, you can see how kids operate. They have arguments. They get over it. They work things out, often without any intervention by the supervisor. They're not skilled at diplomacy or people management. They're just doing what comes naturally. Now suppose that the nursery supervisor did a very strange thing and introduced a new kind of game. Except it's not a nice game, it's a rather sick game with sick rules. In this new game, the supervisor gives all the toys to one child. Let's call him Rex. And all the other children have nothing. They can't play with any toy unless they get Rex's permission first. Now, Rex has all the toys, and so Rex has something else too. A new thing that didn't exist before. Rex has got power. If other children want toys to play with, which they will do, being kids, they have to do what Rex says. By his ownership, Rex has power over them. From not being any issue at all, power becomes the central issue, the thing which defines all relationships, the thing that tells the children who they are. This power automatically puts the children in a separate class from Rex. He is the owning or ruling class. They are the dispossessed or toyless class. So, from a peaceful and more or less harmonious kindergarten, we've moved to a mutually hostile and suspicious class society of unequals. Pretty cool game, eh? but there's more. To play this game properly, Rex has to deal with a number of problems. Let's allow him an intelligence slightly in advance of the average three-year-old. First of all, he has to devise strategies for keeping the other children divided amongst themselves so they won't gang up on him. He won't keep power for long if he doesn't solve this problem first. Right now, the thing to do is to pick out the biggest children and offer them a deal. You protect me against them, and I'll give you some extra rights. It would seem to be in their individual interest to accept this deal. This small band of big kids can be Rex's police force against the Toilers. In fact, they can even be his toy soldiers against the world. If any of the Toilers get out of line, the toy police can soon give her a black eye and put her in her place. So Rex has invented a coercive hierarchy with himself at the top. So far, so good. But it doesn't take long before Rex finds it rather tedious to have to spend his entire time giving orders and organizing everything. Why not hire some administrators to do it for him? Good idea. Well, now he's just invented a kind of coercive state administration, all to protect his property and his position. But it doesn't end there. He doesn't want pandemonium and endless arguments. He wants a stable working system with himself in charge. What he really needs is legitimacy. He needs to make the children believe that it is entirely natural, right and proper, that he should have all the toys and they have nothing. If they believe this, they won't see any reason to rebel. Rebelling against Rex would be as ridiculous as rebelling against the sun or the moon or the rain. So how do you make something seem legitimate? Answer: propaganda and persuasion. Rex needs to come up with a lot of propaganda to justify it all, which we can call a set of ideas or an ideology of power. He then teaches this ideology in the kindergarten, in the new school lessons he has devised. We don't need to know what this ideology is. It doesn't matter how he justifies himself, as long as he does. He can say anything he likes, as long as it works. He can do other things too, like dress up in fancy clothes, maybe wear a wig when he's judging wrongdoers, sit on a tall chair so that he looks down on everyone, speak in a funny voice, use long or foreign words that he knows they won't understand. There are all sorts of things he can do to sound important, big and clever. Eventually, if he does it right, they'll believe he is more important, big and clever than they are. And they'll believe in the natural order of things. He will be the natural order of things to them. They will never rebel. Or maybe they will. What could he do to make doubly sure? In the long run, the best trick is if he can teach them to hate each other. Whites and blacks, boys and girls, Jews and Gentiles, big ears and little ears. Again, whatever works. If they can never trust each other, they can never be too strong for him. So he starts to give treats to the white kids, but extra punishments to the black kids, saying that blacks don't really deserve any better. And he encourages the whites to bully the blacks. Ideology. Divide one way. clever, hey. But not only that, he tells every boy to take a girl as his personal property. And if she doesn't like it, give her a black eye. He encourages boys to bully girls. Divide two ways. Then he can start on religion. Three ways, four ways, five ways. There are any number of possibilities because children are all different and you can exploit those differences. And when they're all fighting each other and he's got them running scared, he can tell them they're all basically criminals who need to be kept in control by his police. He can tell them that they need even more police, more criminal laws, more sin bins, more surveillance. If he's good at it, he can get the children themselves actually demanding more police, more laws, more sin bins, more surveillance. This might all sound very clever, but this is only the sort of thing Machiavelli used to make a living advising Italian princes about. As for the toilers' children, it's no use having them just sitting there doing nothing. They should be doing something useful. Otherwise they'll be causing trouble. They need to be put to work. Well, a kindergarten should have new toys, shouldn't it? That's what it's there for. Well, that's what the toilers can do. They can make new toys for Rex. And in return, Rex might pay them with a little bit of temporary playtime. Call it holiday, or weekend, or leisure. Instead of toilers, they can be toilers. The dispossessed class can become a working class. They're kept too busy to think straight, and Rex gets more and more toys. Great. But there's more. Rex has got ambitions for expansion. And he's got his eye on a kindergarten over the road. And all the lovely toys in there. Not only that, but he's worried. His opposite number over there might be thinking about expansion too, into Rex's territory. What Rex needs to do is act first. Get across that main road with a big toy army. And don't forget, he can explain to all the children that it's all a question of defense. Ideology.
Well, you saw that in the article, this last week's Economist magazine that you were talking about, the article about food prices.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Economist has been keeping a chart on food prices since 1845.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed the chart going back to 1845. And it was flat all the way until, like, 1920 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was completely flat for almost 100 years.
That's
there was
right.
no difference in the price of food. Little tiny wobbles, but nothing much. But then it goes just like a hockey stick. It just goes straight up from like the 70s.
Yeah, well, at the beginning of the central bank era in the United States in 1913 is what we have the problems now. In other words, your purchasing power, which is perfectly capable of remaining consistent over large periods of time, including an entire lifetime. These central banks, and if you're a worker and you're saving, and that's your store of wealth, the bankers and the speculators out there who are at war with the workers and the savers, they service the speculating class. You know, the speculating class, in order to speculate successfully, you need to be able to avoid losing any money on your speculations. Because typically, if you roll the dice, your chances of being consistently making winning bets on rolling the dice are not consistent with, are not going to outperform the random nature of rolling the dice. Nobody can roll the dice and bet on a roll of a dice consistently and consistently win. You know, you can't go to the casino and just pick roulette wheel winners consistently. The chances are that it just doesn't happen. So, but people who go to the casino of global finance they have built a system today where if they roll a winner, if they pick a winner, they get to keep the winnings. And if they pick a loser, they get the banking system to print them a lot of money, to print them money to paper over their loss. Now, the unfortunate side effect is that the purchasing power of all the money in existence is debased. This is why the price of food, and the price of oil, and the price of necessities are continue to go up. It takes more of these debased dollars to buy the same stuff because the speculators out there who are in league with the bankers, they refuse to take any losses.
13 million. Who will give me 14? I have 14 million. Do I hear 15? 15, 16, there to you, sir.
Political power doesn't come cheap in America.
Sold for $22 million of other rollback in air quality regulations.
George Bush understands that money equals power. His campaign spent nearly $50 million this March alone. That's a record.
Next on the block, the First Amendment. Who will give me 1 million?
Just because it's a democracy doesn't mean it's free. How much is your vote worth?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
Are you tired of living like a savage? Tired of wondering where your next meal will come from? Bored with nothing but agriculture and pastoral living? Then why not try civilization? Here's how it works. Our civilization engineers will arrive and take stock of the situation. They will assess your land value and decide what useful resources your land has to offer. Then, our efficiency experts will determine how best to liberate those resources for productive use. But don't worry, our team won't forget your most valuable resource. That's right, your labor power. Our consultants will quickly organize your people to make the best use of their time and productive energy. Before long, your people will have jobs and be well on their way to a civilized lifestyle. Following a brief period of transition, during which our specialists will help educate the public and counter objections, you'll have all the benefits of civilized society, including wages, paid hourly for your hard labor. With these wages, you'll be able to buy food, clothing, and shelter. In fact, everything you used to provide for yourself will now be provided by someone else. Plus, instead of having to do a variety of things, you'll only have to do one thing. Your life will be simplified. In your new civilized society, you won't wonder where your next meal is coming from. You'll know it's coming from your next paycheck. As long as you do what our experts tell you to do, we'll make sure you have enough to make ends meet. But wait, there's more. As an added bonus, we'll make sure your kids get an education to prepare them for the civilized life. Within a few short generations, your people won't remember that there was ever another way to live. Even better, your contributions will make it possible for our civilization planners to spread civilization throughout the world. Not convinced yet? Then here's the best reason to choose civilization. There is simply no alternative. Civilization, it's your future today.
The Parable of the Water Tank, a revision of the story by Edward Bellamy. There once was a very dry land called Root, where the lives of all the people were daily focused on their need to collect water. In Root there were no lakes or rivers, but there were widely scattered oases, where stands of palm trees grew, surrounded by grass and flowers. In some of these oases, there were springs where cool, fresh water would flow onto the surface and collect in the shallow ponds. Each day, the people of Root would walk to the nearest spring, often miles away, to collect the water that they would need for the day's drink and cooking and washing. Some days, the flow of water in the springs was low, and the people who came to collect water were many, so that some who walked to the spring had to return home with only a few sips for their spouses and children and their elderly parents. Once a man of Root went to an oasis to collect his daily water, but he found that that day no water poured forth from the spring. In desperate need, he considered that since water usually flowed at this place, that it must come from some source under the ground. With this thought in mind, he took a shovel and began to dig. After hours passed in his labors, he eventually reached an underground river, which had been the source of the spring. He lowered his bucket into this river that he had discovered and drank deeply. But some were still present when the digger reached water, and they ran over in delight and attempted to fill their buckets. But the man who had dug the well was angered and beat them off with his shovel. "I have water because I alone dug this well," he shouted. "Do you think that you can just come over here and take what I've produced?" One in the crowd called back, "We are poor and have little, but we must have water or we will die. I have 2 pennies only, but I will give these to you for 1 bucket of water." The man who had dug the well agreed and offered the same exchange to all others. Those who had 2 pennies paid and filled their buckets. Those who had no pennies returned home with their buckets empty. The man who had dug the well realized that owning it set him apart from all of the other people of Root. To maintain this distinction, he built walls around the well to keep all others out, so that they could get water from it only if they paid him with 2 pennies. And this man became rich from the pennies he collected, and he became known as a taker. Other men of Root soon heard what had happened at this oasis, and were inspired by the good fortune of the taker. They set out to each of the other oases, where the people of Root who had no pennies went for water. They each dug wells and diverted the underground river so that water no longer flowed into the public springs. They built fences around the wells so that none could take water without their permission, and they gave water only to those who would pay them. And they all became known as takers. But the people of Root were thirsty and poor, and soon had few pennies, and they begged the takers to give them water. But the takers said, "We cannot do that, because then we would become as poor as you are, and we would perish with you. But if you will be our servants, we will provide you with water." And so it happened that the people of Root became the servants of the takers. The takers ordered their servants into teams with supervisors and managers. Some they put at the wells to dip, and others they made to build water wheels, and some to search for new springs. Some of the people were hired to build a tank in the center of the town to hold the water, and this tank was called the market. And the taker said to the people, "For every bucket of water that you take from our wells and bring to us and pour into the market, we will pay you a penny. You may then buy water from the tank for you and your families to drink and cook and wash for 2 pennies a bucket. The difference shall be our profit. If it were not for this profit, we would not do this for you, and you would all perish." The people of Root were happy that the takers had solved the perennial shortage of water, and glad for the work by which they earned the money to buy it. They diligently brought water to the tank every day, and for every bucket they brought, the takers paid them a penny. But for every bucket of water that the takers drew from the market to give to the people gave the takers 2 pennies. After many days, the market overflowed. As for every bucket they poured in, they received only enough to buy 1/2 bucket. Because of the excess that was left to every bucket, the market overflowed. The people were many and the takers were few, and could drink no more than the others. And when the takers saw the market overflow, they told the people to bring them no more water until the market was empty. But when the people could no longer earn pennies from the takers for the buckets of water they bought, they could not buy water from the market. And when the takers saw that they had no more profit, because no man bought water from them, they were troubled. They decided that they had to advertise, and sent forth men to cry, "If any thirst, let him come to the market and buy water from us." But the people answered, "How can we buy unless you hire us so that we may earn money? Hire us as before, and we'll buy water because we are thirsty, and you will have no need to advertise." The takers replied, "Shall we hire you to bring water when the market is already overflowing? First you have to buy the water, and when the tank is empty, then we will hire you again." And so the people did not work. And because they did not work, they could not buy. And minstrels reported abroad that root was in crisis. The people thirsted as never before because they could not collect water at the oasis, as their fathers had done. The takers had taken all of the springs, and the wells, and the water wheels, and the buckets, so that no man could get water except from the market. The people begged the takers, "The tank is overflowing. Please give us water so that we do not die." But the takers answered, "The water is ours. If you want it, you have to buy it." And they confirmed this with an oath to each other, saying, "Business is business." But the takers were worried because they sold so little water. They said, "Our profits have stopped our profits. Because of the profits we've made, we can't make any more profits. How is it that our profits have become unprofitable, and our gains now make us poor? We must send for the soothsayers to interpret this for us." And the soothsayers had several explanations. One blamed it on the overproduction, another on the failure of the people of Root to save their pay, and yet another on lack of confidence. When the takers sent the soothsayers to the people, the soothsayers told them that now they must thirst because there was too much water. But the people became angry, chased the soothsayers away with stones, and cried out, "Do you mock us? Does plenty bring famine? Does nothing come of much?" When the takers saw this anger, they were afraid that the people might storm the water tank. So they sent their holy men, who were false priests, to calm the crowd. The false priests told the people that their thirst was an affliction from God to test their souls, that they should bear it in patience and not trouble the takers. Then they proved the takers' generosity by going to the market and wetting their fingertips in the overflow and scattering the drops upon the people who thronged the tank. The drops of water were called charity, and they were bitter. But the crowd raged even more than before. Since both the soothsayers and the false priests had failed to calm the people of Root, the takers next called upon all who had skill in war. "If you will guard our tanks, then we will pay you money so that you may buy water for yourselves and your families," the takers told them. And the men of war were persuaded by their thirst and took their swords into their hands and struck down the people who thronged the tank. In the following days, the takers made fountains and fish ponds and flower gardens, and they bathed in the water with their wives and children, and wasted the water for their pleasure. When the market was empty, they proclaimed, "The crisis is ended." They hired the people again to bring water from the wells to the market, and paid them as before, a penny for every bucket. But for every bucket that was taken from the tank, the takers received 2 pennies. And so after a time, the market once again overflowed, and once again the word was spread that there was a crisis. Time and again the tank overflowed and the people of Root thirsted. And when, after suffering their agony, the market was empty, the people of Root could once again buy the water they needed. And the recurrent overflowing and emptying of the water tank was called the cycles of the market. After many cycles of the market, there arose in the land certain men who were called agitators, because they stirred up the people. And the agitators told the people that they should freely associate, and then they would have no need to be servants of the takers, and would no longer thirst. The agitators asked the people, "Why can you not buy water from the market?" "Because you have no money." "Why do you have no money?" "Because for every bucket you put into the market, you receive 1 penny. But for every bucket you take from the market, you must pay 2 pennies, so that the taker must have his profit. So the tank must overflow, being filled by your lack and made to abound out of your emptiness. Do you not see that the harder you work and the more diligently you bring the water, the worse off you will be, and not the better? And that this is because of the system of profit, which will keep the people of Root poor forever." The agitators told this story at every opportunity, wherever they could, to whomever would listen. At last there were people who responded to them, "You are right. It is because of the takers and their profits that we cannot receive the fruit of our labor. The more we toil to fill the market, the sooner it overflows, and we receive nothing because there is too much. But what can we do to end the cycles of the market?" And the agitators replied, "What do the takers do for you that you should give them profits from your labor? you collect the water and transport it. But from the takers, you receive only a little of the water you have brought. Here is how to free yourselves from bondage. Do for yourselves what is done by the takers, namely, the ordering of your labor and the marshaling of your bands and the dividing of your tasks. Organize yourselves. Set your production goals to meet the needs of all of the people of Root, but not with an eye to profit. Assign to every worker a job to which he is suited and that pleases him. And when he tires of that job, let him find another way to help the production. And as each person produces more than he can use, and the product of each worker's labors are multiplied by the cooperation of others, let each man take from the market all that he needs. Then you will have no need at all for the takers, and will not yield them profits. Then you shall share as brothers all the fruits of your labor, so the tank shall never overflow until each man is full. And afterward, with the overflow, you shall make pleasant fish ponds and fountains to delight yourselves, just as the takers did. But these shall be for the pleasure of all. And the people of Root cried out with one voice, "Equality, brotherhood, and freedom forever!" The takers heard the shouting and what the people said. And the soothsayers heard it too, as did the false priests and the men of war. And they trembled and said to one another, "It is the end of us." And the people did the things the agitators had told them to do. Soon there were no longer any thirst in the land, and no one who hungered or was naked or cold or suffered any manner of want. And Root enjoyed the blessings of prosperity and peace forever after.
Remember the original kindergarten? The kids were all equals. They shared the toys. It was pretty much peace and harmony most of the time. If any kids whisper about those days now, Rex will have them beaten up or put in the corner or the sin bin. Or just laughed at. Equality, peace, harmony, sharing. That's just a utopia. An idle dream. A kid's fantasy, says Rex. It never happened. It never existed. It never could happen, says Rex. Just look in the history books I've had printed especially for you. And anyway, says Rex, look at yourselves. You hate each other. You are evil. You beat each other up. You're nothing better than wild animals. You need a strong leader like me to keep you in line. If you were set loose and free to have all the toys, what would you do? You'd kill each other and burn the kindergarten down. I'm going to make you all read Lord of the Flies just to prove it. You're bad. That's why I'm in charge, says Rex. And you know what? The children agree with him. We're bad, they say. We can't trust each other. We have criminal natures. We need to be ruled. They believe every word of this because by now they're not children anymore. They've grown up and become what Rex wanted them to become. And they've forgotten their childhood dreams. They are adults. And they accept the world the way it is. The way it has to be. Utopias are fairy tales. Children's stories. It's only a story. It doesn't explain everything. We haven't got all day to explain everything. One thing, though. In the game, I said that the person in charge of the kindergarten invented the game one day, invented the idea of private property, and started by giving all the toys to one child. Of course, private property wasn't suddenly invented one day, and it didn't all suddenly fall in the hands of one person. It took a long time. It evolved. If this is the time humans have been around on this planet, then this is about when we invented settled farming and stopped being hunter-gatherers, about 12,000 years ago. Yesterday, really, in fact. So for about 250,000 years, we've been hunter-gatherers, tribal, primitive, nomadic. Hunter-gatherers had private property, personal effects, bead necklaces, favourite flint knives, that sort of thing. Some of it was valuable too, it meant a lot to them. But hunter-gatherers were travellers. They had to follow the herds and the wild game, or actually the vegetation. Since most of their diet was the gathering, not the hunting, they tended to pick an area clean and then move on. Either way, to them, private property was something you had to be able to carry. Small things. Things that were nice, but personal, private. Maybe good for swapping. Little treasures of your own. People think the pyramids are ancient. You have no idea how modern, how recent they are in the human story. Hunter-gatherers had no use for monuments and houses and things they couldn't take with them. No point staking claim to a piece of land. For most of the time humans have been on this planet, private property was small items, often beautifully made in gold, but still just portable trinkets. The point is that property existed, but it wasn't an issue. But around 12,000 years ago, farming developed. People stayed put on the land to farm it. And in view of the work they were putting in, they needed to defend it. So the land itself became property. And then it all changed, because private property of land was very definitely an issue. A life or death issue. If you had land, you could live. If you didn't, you'd die. And that's when you got your pyramids and your cities and your Stonehenges and your hill forts. When I made up this kindergarten game, I pretended that private property was suddenly invented. It wasn't. But it suddenly acquired an enormous significance 12,000 years ago that it didn't have before. The agricultural revolution was the beginning of a society that didn't just include the concept of private property, it was actually based on it, built on it, like pyramids are built on the earth. I also lied about all the property being given to one person. It wasn't. Not at first, anyway. So what happened there? The bottom line is, 10 people start with 10p each. Eventually one person will own a pound and 9 people will have nothing. That's how property society works. It's like the game of Monopoly. Eventually one person wins everything and everyone else has nothing. Property society may have been equal when it started off, but it didn't stay equal for very long, and it's never been equal since. Capitalism is a big version of the kindergarten game, but the stakes are a lot higher. Imagine playing Death Monopoly, where the rule was that every player who lost all their houses had to have a bullet in the head. You wouldn't play, would you? Capitalism is like a game of Monopoly with life or death outcomes, and we don't have any choice but to play. Our ideology, that word again, tells us that competition is what makes everything happen. Well, competition is usually what games are about. And it can be lots of fun when it's a game. Cooperative games aren't usually that exciting. But we're talking about amusement, not life and death. Forcing people to play a competitive game where most of the rules are rigged to begin with, and the outcomes can be fatal. It's not funny. It's pretty sick. We think competition runs the world, but all it does is keep us running, often for sheer terror.
I pledge obedience to the flag of the United States of America, and to the corporations for which it stands, one nation, uninformed, in denial, with liberty and justice forsaken, forbidden, and forgotten. Just because we know we are right, just because we think we are free, because we have such military might, we are killing for the oil companies. Just because our statesmen are weak, and in the guise of Christianity, just to keep our headlights burning bright, we are killing for the oil companies. From 60,000 feet in the air, our heroes take out heathens from their padded easy chairs. Just because we saw it on TV, from journalists with no integrity, who laugh and smile while other nations bleed, as we are killing for the oil companies.
Our current economic paradigm goes back to the days of European colonialism. European society was basically expanding outward to encompass the rest of the world, to control the rest of the world's resources. And so that created economic growth for Europe. And so the very first economic theorists started to build this idea of growth into their theories. Now, during the 19th and 20th centuries, as fossil fuels came along, we had enormous expansion in human capabilities. We had energy available to fuel industrialization and the growth of everything, of mechanization, using machines to do work that formerly had been done by human beings. So that also created enormous growth. So as economics, as a system developed, of course, we think of economics these days as a science, but economics is not a science. It started out as a moral philosophy, and it still is, in effect, a kind of moral philosophy. But into the very bedrock of economics, whether it's leftist economics or rightist economics, Marxist or free market, it doesn't matter. It's all basically the same, is this idea that mechanization is inevitable, and that the economy will, can, and must continue to grow. Now, of course, this is an absurdity because we live on a finite spherical planet. So there's only so much stuff to chew up and spit out. But we have this economic theory now that we're burdened with, which says that we have to chew up and spit out more all the time. We've even created a monetary system that underscores this. Our money is created through bank loans these days. It's not backed up by gold or silver. It's essentially fiat money that's created by the act of making a loan. When the loan's repaid, the money disappears. So all of those loans, of course, have interest attached to them. So if the interest is going to be paid on all of the loans that exist, that means that the money supply has to continually grow. And if the money supply stops growing, that means that a lot of people are going to default on their loans, and money just disappears from the economy, and we have a deflationary depression, which is what we had back in the 1930s. So in order to avoid a deflationary depression, we have to have continual growth in the money supply, which has to be based on continual growth in economic activity, which must be based on the continual growth in available energy and raw materials to fuel economic activity. Well, of course, that's simply not in the cards. We can't have that because it's physically impossible. We'll be right back.
people as they flee from our huge Air Force jets that we fly across the sea, and our proud cluster bombs that destroy life and limb for generations to come from the ground that they lay.
Hello, I'm Lee Hing Mui. If you're like me, you can't bear to just stand by and watch as climate change wreaks havoc on the planet. Storms, droughts, islands sinking, ice caps melting, polar bears extinct by 2026? I don't want to see them all die. Fortunately, there is something we can do about it. Buy green. Where we put our dollars is the difference between human extinction and an exciting new eco lifestyle. Eco fashion, eco sexy. Organic cotton jeans from Egypt. Renewable bamboo frocks from Vietnam. Chemises spun by free-range Chinese silkworms. Come on, people, do we really need to cage our silkworms? Greensumers can enjoy organic apples from New Zealand, organic oranges from Israel, organic flowers from Senegal, and organic cherries from Chile, all in the dead of winter. Who needs the Kyoto Protocol when we can shop against climate change? I dumped my old 2005 Honda for a Toyota Prius. Now we have a Prius for every member of the family, and there's seven of us. So now we're saving the planet seven times faster.
Costs involved in the production of a Prius, and all the energy costs and material costs involved, and all of the mines and all of the lands that have been ripped up to make that happen, it's profoundly harmful. If you need a new car, the best decision to make is to buy a good used car.
And what about where we live? Housing too is also going green. Home Depot now offers an eco options aisle. When we built our second home, we made sure it was green, all 10,000 square feet of it. To power our remarkable eco lifestyles, alternatives to fossil fuels include clean coal and biofuels. Imagine fuel that actually grows on huge tracts of agricultural land in Africa, South America, and India. Land wasted on peasants becomes land for energy. True, thousands of natives will be displaced. But hey, everyone's got to chip in to save the planet.
Keep your sunny side up, up. Hide the side that gets blue. If you have nine suns in a row, baseball teams make money, you know. That funny side.
Clean coal is the latest technological hope to free us from oil dependency. Scientists are working to discover how to capture and bury billions of tons of coal's toxic CO2, just like they do with nuclear waste. Should it ever leach out into our rivers, we can always rely on scientists to figure out what to do next. Yes, we still can have it all. Style and sustainability. Just keep shopping green. If we keep it up and have a booming Christmas season this year, we will save those darling polar bears.
The totality of consumption is what the problem is. The totality of impact on the earth. And that's why we speak so much of conservation being the key rather than better consumption, using less stuff rather than manufacturing things in a better way. So cut back and power down and use less of the materials of the earth.
Well, yeah, inflation is a way to increase the wealth and income gap and to create a feudal aristocratic class. And that's the, you know, inflation and control of the money supply and the way that the monetary way it works, you know, back in the medieval days and the dark ages with kings and lords and princes and whatnot, with indentured servants who are perpetually in debt. And the aristocratic lords. I mean, this is what America yearns for. This is why I'm saying that the experiment to leave Germany, as I did, my family did 300 years ago, to go to America, was a complete waste of time because the idea was to go to Pennsylvania. We were invited by William Penn to help create Pennsylvania, which was for religious freedom because we were tired of the religious wars 300 years ago in Europe, and you know, which led to the colonies banding together and staging a war of independence against Britain, the colonial ruler. Okay, 220 years later, everyone in the country, all of my ancestors, and especially around Pennsylvania, in the Pennsylvania area, Lancaster, Pennsylvania area, if you go to the local cemetery, you'll see dozens and dozens, scores and scores of Kaisers buried there. You know, all of that work and hope to create a democratic free society has been completely obliterated within 8 years as Bush has overturned civil rights, the Wall Street's overturned contract law, and we're back to usurious feudal lords who are subjugating the people and enslaving them with debt.
Fall of the House of Capital? By the time you hear this, the $700 billion bailout will have been old news. One of the biggest transfers of wealth in history. But it will not heal that which ails the nation as it trips and stumbles like a drunken sailor on shore leave. The reasons are simple, for the problems are systemic, built into the rapacious nature of the machinery humming all around us. This Rube Goldberg-like contraction of democratic forms at the service of the financial services industry is a bottomless maw, a gaping mouth that is never sated. Why was there no alarm when millions of people lost their homes to foreclosures made inevitable by variable mortgage rates? When millions lost manufacturing jobs to low-paying service gigs? When living standards crumbled and when take-home pay fell to 1972 levels? Where was the alarm? There was no alarm, for this was the blind market at work. The leveling way of globalism, the new world moving through, preparing the way for the triumph of capitalism uber alles. Few were the politicians who gave voice to this immense social suffering. Fewer still used their power to try to assuage their pain, for they too were drunk on the wine of globalism. But when the ripple spread upwards, from the foreclosed homes to the foreclosing banks, and from the banks to investment houses, Congress steered from their drunken stupor and rang alarm bells the loudest. It's an economic 9/11, yelled some. It's a financial tsunami, said others. When Americans were hoodwinked into subprime loans and millions were faced with foreclosures, where was the alarm? More importantly, where was the help for those who were endangered? Nowhere. Nowhere. If they were helped, the present economic crisis would have been mitigated. Karl Marx and Frederick Engels wrote 160 years ago that the state is but the executive for the capitalists. After what we've seen, who can doubt it? The empire is crumbling. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
So corporate capitalism moves restlessly into all corners of the world, destroying happy communities in the Philippines, in the Amazon, in Africa, in the United States for fast buck plunder. In the Philippines, you have these free business zones. They'll go into islands and communities where people have orchards and groves and fish and plant and have been living there for who knows how many centuries and living a good life, and they come in, drive these people off the land with these phony deeds and then just harvest all the all the timber that's there, and tropical areas can't survive, that kind of thing. It turns it into a wasteland, worse for the ecology, worse for the air, worse for that. These people are driven off into the shanty towns, and there you got the free market, transnational corporate free market, doing its thing, pursuing its profits, and destroying human lives, human communities, ways of life, and the environment.
Little white lies been around for years. Little white lies ringing in your ears. You turn around, come around back on you. Well, that little white lie's catching up to you. You're talking too much.